going to be reading from Mark 9, 14 through 32. When they came to the disciples, they saw a great crowd around them, and some scribes arguing with them. When the whole crowd saw him, they were immediately overcome with awe, and they ran forward to greet him. He asked them, "What are you arguing about with them?" Someone from the crowd answered him, "Teacher, I brought you my son. He has a spirit that makes him unable to speak. And whenever it seizes him, it dashes him down, and he foams and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. And I asked your disciples to cast it out, but they could not do so." He answered them, "You faithless generation, how much longer must I be among you? How much longer must I put up with you? Bring him to me." And they brought the boy to him, and when the spirit saw him immediately, it convulsed the boy, and he fell on the ground and rolled about, foaming at the mouth. Jesus asked the father, "How long has this been happening to him?" And he said, "From childhood. It has often cast him into the fire and into the water to destroy him. But if you are able to do anything, have pity on us and help us." Jesus said to him, "If you are able, all things can be done for the one who believes." Immediately the father of the child cried out, "I believe, help my unbelief." When Jesus saw that a crowd came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, "You spirit that keeps this boy from speaking and hearing, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again." After crying out and convulsing him terribly, it came out, and the boy was like a corpse, so that most of them said, "He is dead." But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up, and he was able to stand. And when he entered the house, his disciples asked him privately, "Why could we not cast it out?" He said to them, "This kind can only come out through prayer." They went on from there and passed through Galilee. He did not want anyone to know it, for he was teaching his disciples, saying to them, "The Son of Man is to be betrayed into human hands, and they will kill him. And 3 days after being killed, he will rise again." But they did not understand what he was saying, and were afraid to ask him. And you can imagine they probably were afraid to ask him after they asked him the last question, and he kind of scolded them a little bit. Title of the sermon is Casting Out Demons. We're not really going to literally talk about casting out demons. What we're going to talk about is faith, and how if you have enough faith, you could cast out demons. Most of us, however, are cursed with a sense of the impossible. And that's precisely why miracles do not happen. But not only is it the reason miracles don't happen, it's the reason our lives are so humdrum and routine, hemmed in and dull. The reason the church is so bland in its witness that not many stop to take note of what's going on among our Christians. We are cursed with a sense of the impossible. We have a hard time believing. And we have a hard time having faith. David Heller, he's a young Boston psychologist, he has this continuing research interest. He collects letters from children who have written to God. He's published a few books, and in his second publication, Dear God, Children's Letters to God, appears the following letter. "Dear God, I have doubts about you sometimes. Sometimes I really believe, like when I was 4 and I hurt my arm and you healed it up fast. But my question is this. If you could do this, why don't you stop all the bad in the world? Like war, like disease, like famine, like drugs. And there are problems in other people's neighborhoods too. I'll try to believe more." Signed, Ian. Most of us can probably relate to Ian's child letter to God. How many times have we asked the same questions? How many times have we wondered, if God can do such great things, if God can heal, why does he not stop the suffering that's going on in our world? I'm sure we've all asked ourselves that question. It's not just a children's question. This whole story that I read out of the Bible comes after the Transfiguration. You remember when Jesus took Peter, James, and John up on the mountain, and they saw Jesus transfigure himself into this bright light, talking to some previous people, and they were all in great awe. This was a glorious moment. But then they came down the mountain, and that's where we are this morning, where they came down the mountain. And in most translations of the Bible, what I read is titled, Healing an Epileptic Boy. It appears in three of the synoptic gospels, in all three of them. And they kind of link them together. The glory at the mountaintop and the suffering in the valley. And that's how life is. Sometimes we just glory in the great things that happen to us. And other times we get depressed and suffer because the reality of life brings us back down to earth. There's a great painting by an Italian painter named Raphael, and it's depicting the descent from the Mount of Transfiguration. He depicts in a powerful fashion the striking contrast between the top of the mountain and the bottom. Above, the beauty of that high and holy vision, which we call the Transfiguration of Jesus, and below, the tragic need and suffering, the impotence of the disciples, and the fruitless discussion of it. So does life have its stark contrast just like that. Sometimes we go from the beauty of worship, maybe right here, maybe at home, to find ugliness outside. We move from peace and tranquility to turmoil in our homes, in our work, in our world. But that's where we live. That's what we have to deal with. Jesus took his closest disciples with him up on the mountain. But then they came back into the marketplace, and this is where all this transpired. And Jesus cast out a demon. And the disciples couldn't figure out why. They tried, but couldn't. And Jesus kind of got a little perturbed. You faithless people, how long do I have to put up with this? And you can kind of tell Jesus is getting a little frustrated because he knows that his time is coming. And he's been trying to teach his disciples that, look, if you've got faith, you can do anything. You can move mountains. You can cast out demons. You can do anything. One of my favorite quotes, and I've probably mentioned this before, is faith is not believing God can. Faith is knowing God will. Think about that. Faith is not believing God can. We know God can. Faith is knowing that He will do that for you. That's what faith is all about. In the Interpreter's Bible, there's comments on the phrase going downhill. Said it is usually applied to people in a disparaging or pitying manner. When we say of anybody he or she is going downhill, we mean that that person has seen better days. But there is a nobler sense of the word as well, the sense in which Jesus spent his whole life going downhill from the high and lonely places where he held communion with God to the level, crowded places of human need. There are those who spend much of their time in the fine art of going uphill. We're always trying to climb the ladder. We're always trying to do better for ourselves. But that means we're not paying attention to the finer art of going downhill. It's that lifelong descent from privilege to need. And I'm sure we'd all like to escape that need, that suffering, that bad place, if you will. So we take vacations, or retreats, if you will. Retreats is the word that can be used for refreshment. We think of retreats as a time to help us get ourselves back together. William Barclay writes, "Solitude is not meant to make us solitary. It is meant to make us better able to meet and cope with the demands of everyday life. How often when Jesus was confronted with the heavy theological questions, he turned people's attentions back away from heaven to their neighbors in need here on earth. When Jesus came down the mountain, he saw a great crowd engaged in a heated argument. And when they saw Jesus, they stopped. There was something about Jesus that amazed them, something that put them in awe. And the Bible doesn't tell us what exactly it was. He may have still been glowing a little bit from his transfiguration, kind of like Moses. Every time he went to go see God face to face, he'd shine a little bit brighter, to the point where he had to wear a veil or the people couldn't look at him. So we don't know, but that may be it. And then Jesus asks them, "What are you discussing?" And the terrible irony in that word discussing is that we do too much of it. In the presence of deep and agonizing emergencies, we discuss what's going to happen. There's a paraphrase of Matthew 25 that says, "I was hungry, and you formed a discussion group to discuss world hunger." And I know that kind of seems a little out there, but that's how we deal with life. How many times in the history of the church have Jesus' disciples faced some kind of appalling human need but been preoccupied with discussion? We talk about things, and we're very good at it. We Methodists especially have a penchant for thinking that if we have thoroughly debated it and passed a resolution, then we've really done something. We think it's better to discuss something without resolving it than resolve something without discussing it. Just like the situation that our greater Methodist church is in right now. Instead of doing something about it, instead of putting our fist down and saying, "The Bible says, and this is the way it's going to be," we're discussing it. We're taking it to judicial council. We're taking it back to the conference. And because of that, other conferences are beginning to do the same thing, when we should have put our foot down and said, "Look, this is the way it is. Like it or leave it." But we don't do that. We don't have the faith and trust and hope in God that we should. We discuss it. Going back to this poor father, this was his only child. Luke 9:38 tells us that. His only child who had these seizures and these difficulties. And this poor father brought his son to the disciples. And the disciples were powerless. They were not able. And how many times has that been true down through the ages? The world comes to the doorstep of taking care of something, and we are powerless to help. People get ground in depression, guilt, poverty. Instead of fixing things, lifting the burden, we often tend to add to it, or we blame the victim for his or her problems. So why were the disciples not able to fix it? Jesus says, easy. It's from lack of faith. And faith in the Bible means trust. The disciples, in the face of this situation, couldn't do anything. How often have you been in a situation like this? I know Marilyn and I, we go visit people at the hospital, at the nursing home, and sometimes you stand there next to somebody's bed and you feel completely helpless. You pray for the person and you wish that they would do better, God would heal them, and you have the faith that God can heal them, but there's always that little doubt in the back of your mind that says, well, God's doing what he wants to do, and maybe this is just the way it is. We feel powerless. Whereas if we were to stand there next to the bed and boldly trust God, and through boldly having faith, and looked at that person and knew we could do something about it, we could make them get up and walk out of the hospital. We could cast out demons if you believed it strong enough. But therein lies the problem. There's a book called The Martyred by a man named Richard Kim. This book, it's a story that takes place during the Korean War, or the Korean conflict, however you want to put it. It's about an agnostic Captain Lee. Captain Lee comes to know Mr. Shin, who is a Christian pastor. And in the midst of all this suffering that's going on, the Korean War, Captain Lee is constantly asking Mr. Shin, does your God care that people suffer? And Shin, for many months, avoided giving an answer. He ignored it out of his own despair and uncertainty as to what the real answer was. Finally, one day, Captain Lee corners him and says, Shin, your God doesn't care, does he? Your God, any God, all gods of the world, what do they care for us? Your God, he doesn't understand our sufferings. He doesn't want to have anything to do with our miseries, murders, starving people, wars, all the horrors of the earth. Your God couldn't care less. The Christian pastor, Mr. Shin, in his own agonizing unbelief, cries out, all my life I have searched for God, but I have found only man in all his suffering. If he'd have only realized, when he found man in all of his suffering, he found God. Think about that for a minute. If everything went your way all the time, if everything was always good, you had nothing to worry about, why would you need God? If everything was always perfect, you'd have very little need for God. But because we experience suffering in our world, we experience the downtimes, the going downhill, things are not always perfect. We are closer to God during those times because we need Him. And that's where you'll find God. You see the suffering and stuff that goes on around the world, and God is in the middle of that. Because God is helping those people cope with what's going on in their lives. It's not that He's there causing the suffering. It's not that He's there making things worse. God is actually there helping those people cope. As Jesus put it, I didn't come for the healthy. I came for the sick. The healthy have no need of me. God is found in the suffering you see around the world. He is there helping those people. Theologian Paul Tillich talks about during World War I, when he'd visit battlefields, and he talks about how the soldiers would most often express their disbelief in God in terms of not being able to reconcile the notion of a good God with the evil they saw all around them. They would ask, how can there be a loving purpose at the heart of reality and the world be like it is? Albert Einstein confessed that he had his inability to believe in a personal God. Now, if you could preach a sermon to those who have suffered in the world's holocausts and hurricanes and have lost family and friends or experienced earthquakes or other types of terrible devastation, what message of comfort would you give those people, the starving and the homeless and the victimized? There's only one thing I can think of that you could say. There is a God who suffers with us and is involved in the midst of it all. I believe that evil is a problem only for those who believe that God's will is always perfectly done here on earth. God's will is not perfectly done here on earth. We have to want to follow God's will. And you can look around you and see that God's will is not always being followed. That's why Jesus taught us in the Lord's Prayer, "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven." When the kingdom comes, we pray that prayer because we know God's will is not currently being done perfectly on this earth. We see the suffering, and we know that God is with those suffering. Jesus tells those agonized father, the parents, all things are possible to him who believes. All things. That's a pretty broad statement. But he meant what he said. And you have to look at that in the light of Jesus' teaching and in Jesus' life. God doesn't do parlor tricks. God is not a magician. He's not going to provide something that you don't need. You can't go out front of the church and say, "God, I'd sure like to have a Mercedes," and it pop up. It don't happen that way. Jesus knows how we live. Jesus suffered more than we'll probably ever suffer. He knows how it feels. He knows how to relate to us. And yet he tells us all things are possible if you believe. That's all there is to it. Faith is knowing God will. It's not about knowing God can. It's about knowing He will. If you ask, He will give it to you. Jesus was nailed to the cross for us. He was flesh and blood for us. He cares that much for us that He came down from His beautiful blue heaven to suffer among us here on earth, to share in our sufferings. The Father says, "I believe, help my unbelief." How often do we ask ourselves that? I believe, but help my unbelief. Help that little bit in the back of my head that says it ain't going to happen. Help me with that. Help me be a better believer. Jesus' reply was, it's got to be faith. It can only happen through prayer. But if you think about it, the man showed a little bit of faith. He had the faith that the disciples could do something about it, which didn't quite work out. But he had the faith still that he took his son to Jesus. He had that little bit of faith. I believe, help my unbelief. We all have that little bit of faith. But reality tends to slap us in the face sometimes. Jesus wasn't picking on the man. Jesus wanted to help him. But he also wanted to give a lesson. Like he was always doing. If you follow Jesus' journey, nearly everything he did had a lesson in it. He wanted them to understand that it is about faith. It is about trust, hope. It's about praying for those things that you want done. It's praying for the healing of our world. It's praying for the healing of your loved ones, your friends, your neighbors, those people in the hospital or in the nursing home. It's about prayer. It's about praying and believing. It's about when you get up off your knees, you leave it with Him because you know He's going to take care of it. You don't get up off your knees and say, "Well, I did my thing. Maybe it'll work out." You need to get up off your knees and leave it right there because God will take care of it. if you believe enough. Faith can move mountains. Faith can cast out demons. Did you realize that in our world today, especially among young adults, college age, they are searching. They are searching for something to fill that empty spot inside them. Religion classes in college fill up pretty quick. The classes by theologian Harvey Cox at Harvard fill up so quick. There's so many people that want in them, they can't find rooms big enough. They're searching. They're looking for something to fill that void in their heart. They are really looking for God. But our society today doesn't want them to think that way. Our society today wants them to think that it's all about what's going on around you. They need to realize that the only thing that's going to fill that void in their heart is God through Jesus Christ. We always seem to be looking for the easy route. We want the simple fix. We don't want to have it to be a little bit difficult or hard. We want the easy fix. There's a story of a man in the Ozarks out on his front porch with his rocking chair, and he's rocking back and forth, and he'll move his chair a little bit, and he'll rock back and forth, and he'll move his chair a little bit, and he'll rock back and forth. Finally, his wife come out on the porch. She says, "What are you doing?" He says, "Well, can't make up my mind whether it's easier to rock north and south with the grain of the wood or east and west with the wind." Isn't that how we are? We're looking for what's easiest. The fix is not always easy. Sometimes you have to work for it. Praying to God and having faith that He's going to take care of it is 3/4 of the battle. That other 25% is you. I know we all hear the saying, God helps those who help themselves. I hate to tell you, but that is not biblical. That's just something man came up with. But God does help people that really want to help themselves, that get down on their knees and ask Him for something, that get up off their knees and say, "Okay, I've taken care of it because I know God's going to fix it." You have to change your unbelief into belief. Change your weak belief into a stronger belief. Help me in spite of my lack of faith. Help me to be more faithful. It's through prayer, Jesus says. It's through prayer that those things happen. And it's easy when you're here in church on Sunday morning to have all kinds of faith and trust because you're among other Christians who have the same feeling. The problem is Monday through Saturday. You're real strong in it here, but come Monday morning, you start to wonder. And you think, well, maybe. Rick Warren says there's a lot of people who on Sunday morning are singing "Onward, Christian Soldier," and they go AWOL on Monday morning. You have to have faith 24/7. You have to believe 365 days out of the year, 24 hours a day, that God is with you, that God is taking care of you, and God will do what you ask Him to do. It may not be exactly like you ask Him to do, but He's going to do for you what is the best thing for what you asked. Carl Michelson says that ping pong in our minds is necessary. It helps us to mature. It helps us to strengthen our faith as we ping pong that back and forth. We have to believe that God is going to do what we want done. William Lyon Phelps, Yale University, in his autobiography, says, "My religious faith remains in possession of the field only after prolonged civil war with my naturally skeptical mind." Some of us have been through that. Most of us probably been through that, our skeptical minds. Harry Fosdick preached a sermon one time called "The Importance of Doubting Your Doubts." And this is what he says. "One that comes into true faith only after getting to the point where one begins to doubt his or her own doubts." And I know that kind of seems like an oxymoron, doubting your doubts, but it makes sense if you think about it. Because that doubt that's in your mind that things are not going to work out, if you begin to doubt that doubt, then you're moving towards faith. Think about it. It's not a double negative. It's not an oxymoron. It makes sense. Doubt your doubt, and you're moving towards maturity of faith. Harold Bowlesley, who's the minister of First United Methodist Church of Evanston, he says, "We never get beliefs 100% doubt-proof. We can always ask questions about them that no mortal man can answer, but life won't let us wait around until we are 100% certain before we must act. But we must trust our Creator. Many times we act with no more than 51% assurance, and sometimes not even that much. But we must act in the light of the best we know. And this is what we have to do. But nobody escapes faith." Jesus said, or the man said to Jesus, "If you can do anything, have pity on us and help us." And Jesus got a little upset. He says, "What do you mean, if you can? All things are possible if you have enough faith. It's not a matter of what we can or cannot do, but it's mostly up to you. You have to take it or leave it. You have to have faith. You have to believe in God's power. And the need of our faith for God's power gives us that power ourselves. It's mostly up to us." That's what Jesus, in a nutshell, is telling us in those verses. It's about prayer. This can only happen through prayer. It's about faith. And it's about knowing all things are possible. Trust me. Faith means trust. And we began the sermon with that little letter from Ian. I'm going to close the sermon with God's response. God's letter back to Ian. Actually, God answers all of us. He says, "Dear children of mine, you have doubts about me? I have doubts about you sometimes. Sometimes I really believe in you. Like when you come to church on Sunday mornings and tell me how much you love me. But my question is, if you could do this, why don't you stop all the bad in the world? Like war, like disease, like famine, like drugs. You think you've got problems. You should try being God sometimes. On the other hand, whenever you've tried it, the results have not been impressive. So I'll try to believe in you more. Trust me." Signed, God. The troubles that we see around the world, the suffering, the pain, we can do something about that. God believes in us. He trusts us to do something about it. He trusts us to get out into the community and bring others to the faith, to save souls. That is our duty as a Christian. Once you give your life over to Christ and you have that faith and that trust, you should want to bring others to that same faith and trust. It's not about works. It's not about bringing them into the church. It's about saving souls. It's about your faith, your Christian journey. You should want to bring others to Christ to save souls. You should want to do that. So, in a sense, we can cast out demons. We can fix the problems in our world around us if you just stand up for something and do something about it. There was a country and western song quite a few years ago. You've got to stand for something or you'll fall for anything. And that's what's happening in our world today. They'll fall for anything because they don't have anything to stand up to. And even in our church, in our greater Methodist church, as soon as that happened last fall, somebody should have put their fist down and said, no, that is not going to happen. But instead, we've been discussing it for a year. And we're going to keep discussing it until 2019. And that is ridiculous. We all should have gotten down on our knees and said, God, this is wrong. Help us with this. And we could cast out demons. Because I want you to understand that the devil is in the church. He's a great disguiser. And he knows more about the Bible than we'll ever know because he lived it. He knows how to twist things around. He knows how to misinterpret the Bible to their own needs. It's about faith. It's about trusting that God can fix it. It's about knowing that we have the power through God to fix anything. All things are possible if you have enough faith. Amen.